Welcome to an undisclosed location. This is Murder Incorporated. I am Buddy.
And I'm Harley.
Family dinners are awkward when your brother was kidnapped for 7 years. Then your other brother grows up to be the Yosemite Park killer. Was Cary Stainer born evil? Or did his messed up childhood create this monster? You listeners decide. And with that, here's Harley.
Thank you, Buddy. That was amazing, as always.
Of course, man. Let's hear about the sick monster.
So this wonderful fairy tale begins on February 12th, 1999.
Oh, this is recent.
Yeah, not too long ago. Carol's son, her daughter Julie, who is 15 years old, and Silvina Peloso, who is 16 years old, left their house in Eureka, and they started on a vacation at Yosemite State Park.
Okay.
So Silvina was a foreign exchange student, and they were doing like a one last trip before she went back home, you know, go see the sights. They went to Disneyland and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Happy stuff.
Happy stuff. Enjoying the vacation, doing all sorts of great stuff.
Yeah.
Until something happened horrible, I got a feeling.
No, this is a great story. Yeah, this is totally different this week.
Yeah, we're doing happy stories this week.
Mrs. Son and her husband, Jens, were wealthy realtors in the Stockton area of California. And after several weeks of entertaining the Pelosa girl, this was their last big trip before she went back to Argentina.
Okay.
None of them were seen alive again.
No, of course.
The inn staff said that when they cleaned the room the next morning, this was February 16th, they didn't detect anything, like no foul play, nothing.
Okay.
And the keys had been left like they're supposed to be at the room desk, which is customary.
Mm-hmm.
But they were supposed to meet her husband, Jens, at the San Francisco airport to go to Arizona the next day.
Okay.
And while he was at his meetings, the females were going to go tour the Grand Canyon. Local police and Yosemite security began to search the area where the missing girls were last seen.
Mm-hmm.
Initial suspicion was that they may have wandered off the main hiking paths and got lost in the maze of, like, the confusing woodland, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine it's pretty confusing out there.
But soon that assumption dwindled.
Mm.
4 weeks, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Police, family, and volunteers combed this whole area by helicopters, on foot, on ski.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were looking for this car. They rented a red Grand Prix.
Okay.
And it sticks out, and they're looking for this car.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
They didn't find that car, but what they found was over 20 stolen cars, but not that one.
Oh, really?
That's like how intense the search was.
Wow.
But as the days passed, and strangely, Carol's wallet showed up at a Modesto, California street, the FBI felt that something much more sinister than them getting lost was going on.
Mm-hmm.
2 weeks later, FBI predictions darkened. After a massive search and rescue team working around the clock in a 30-mile radius failed to find anyone, anything.
Mm-hmm.
James Murdoch, who was in charge of the investigation, said, "We feel almost certain that the women were victims of violent crime."
Yeah, yeah, definitely after that long.
So right off the bat, basically they were onto this, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it seemed like they really wanted to find these women, and they were just on it from the get-go.
I mean, rich white women lost in California, I mean, they're going to be on it.
Yep.
Because of the discovery of Son's wallet in suburban Modesto, police and FBI canvassed the logical routes in and out of that spot,
mm-hmm.
interviewing homeowners and business owners and anyone who might have seen him.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI relocated its headquarters from Yosemite to Modesto at this point. And on February 28th, 12 days after the women's disappearance, they were no longer treating this as a missing person case, but as a murder.
Yeah.
More than 1,000 leads produced nothing. Nothing at all.
Really? Wow.
But still, the FBI search even more so intensified. As the last days of February stumbled into March, the public still hoped that they would be found alive.
Yeah, well.
In Modesto, they had a vigil where they had for missing persons. And unofficially, Jen Soon offered $250,000 for information that would lead to their safe return.
Mm-hmm.
And after a couple weeks, he upped it to $300,000.
Oh, wow.
But with no luck at all. I mean, they got plenty of tips, they just led nowhere.
Yep. Yeah, well, if you got the money, you know.
I mean, $300,000 brings everybody out of the woodwork.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, the dark and hard reality came. The Soon family worst nightmare came true. When a hiker wandered onto the site of a burned-out red 1999 Pontiac.
And there's the vehicle.
Hidden off the highway. This was March 18th. The California Highway Patrol verified the car's license plate as the rented vehicle that they had.
Yep.
Agents soon swarmed the scene, opening the trunk. Investigators found two charred bodies.
Oh, jeez.
I mean, they couldn't even recognize the bodies. They were burned so bad. But by dental records, they were identified.
Yeah.
So authorities now suspected that young Julie may have met with a similar fate elsewhere. But they held out hope that even though she may be in dire circumstances, that she may still be alive. And the public was like, oh, we got to find this girl alive.
Yeah, yeah.
Scouring the vicinity, FBI agents spread out along Highway 108, questioning locals and stopping cars for any information. But more importantly, to find Julie. It was not long before a note was received by the FBI detailing where to find Julie. It was near Lake Pedro, miles away, and they found the badly decomposed body of Julie.
Mm-hmm.
And this was March 25th. The girl's throat had been slit ear to ear.
Jeez.
Throughout the next several weeks, a task force comprised of law enforcement and FBI agents from four surrounding counties, and they dedicated this task force to no other purpose than to rounding up suspects in the whole area. And they arrested many, many people, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And none of them were the killer. But the thing is like, so they figured that the killer had to be somebody familiar with the area.
Okay.
Because they got a bright red car with nobody seeing it to this place and not being seen or anything like that, that it had to be somebody that knew the area.
Knew the area, knew all the back roads or whatever.
And yeah, exactly.
Knew how to get this car. Yeah, that makes sense.
So they're like rounding up the village idiots, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
One of these guys actually wasn't a village idiot, but he just had bad luck because he worked at the Cedar Lodge where they were last seen alive.
Gotcha.
His name was Billy Joe Strange, and they rounded him up, and they were like, oh, we know you did it, blah, 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 blah. He was on parole.
Gotcha.
And they gave him, and then
he just fit the MO, you know, the...
Yeah, exactly.
The profile.
And they were arresting, like, anyone for any little thing. Like, they arrested him for showing up to parole with the liquor on his breath.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI pushed for Strange's arrest, but he denied any part of the triple murders.
Mm-hmm.
And many friends came forward and said there's no way he could have anything to do with a murderer.
Yeah. What was he on parole for?
I couldn't find that.
Gotcha.
Not murder. Another man they arrested, believing maybe was responsible, was Mick Lorick of Modesto. He and a bunch of his meth head buddies hung around Modesto.
Okay.
And Mick, he was good for it. Mick Lorick, who grew up near the bodies where Carol's son and Silvina Peloso were found, he was arrested on March 16th.
Okay.
After he allegedly shot a police officer.
Oh, really?
And then had a 14-hour standoff with him.
Oh, wow.
So he had such a long criminal record. And after, like, the FBI had arrested all these people, and I'm only listing two. There was a bunch of them.
Yeah.
But they're, like, convinced that within one of these 25 people they arrested, one of them's got to be the killer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the public's like, oh, yeah, they got him. Who knows which one of them it is, but they got him.
Yeah. Yeah, they got faith that they got somebody with all these records and whatnot, but something tells me they don't have them.
And they even said publicly that even though nobody had been charged directly with the murders, that they were fairly confident that they had the murderer in custody.
Of course, you know, you got to keep the public, you know, got to keep them satisfied.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Others, too, had been questioned in the slayings. More routine than anything. One of these mans was named Kerry Stainer.
Ah.
He was clean cut, no record of violence, and was in the employment at the Cedar Lodge.
Okay.
3 weeks after the FBI had all but closed the case, it was reopened.
Okay.
A fourth victim.
Oh.
Brutally murdered just a few miles from the Cedar Lodge. Acting on a tip from a caller who was worried about the whereabouts of his friend, Joey Ruth Armstrong, park rangers found her mutilated body on the morning of July 22nd.
Oh, wow.
My birthday, buddy.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't catch that. That was his birthday.
What a good friend. It was discovered.
Yeah. And is this 1999 still? Or?
Yeah, my 14th birthday,
that
buddy.
That was his 14th birthday, yeah.
That was a good summer.
I bet it was.
Not for her, but...
Yeah, not for her. Not for her at all.
It was discovered beyond a campground near where, like, she lived in, like, people that worked at the park had these cabins. So it was just rows of cabins. Mm-hmm. And then she was found near her cabin. And she was only 26 years old.
Oh, wow.
So she worked at the Yosemite Institute.
Mm-hmm.
They figure by the temperature of her body and everything that she was murdered the day before.
Okay. So he didn't hide that body at all, did he?
No.
Not well enough, at least.
No. It was seen as a crime of passion.
Gotcha.
You'll see why soon.
Okay.
In fact, she had been seen the day before at the institute where she worked. That's why they figured it had to happen that day.
Yeah.
Joey was probably only hours away from leaving her cabin to visit a friend. And then when she didn't appear as planned, like, her friend just immediately knew something was wrong and called the police.
Gotcha.
And her car was right there in front of the cabin with her stuff packed to go to her friend's house.
Ah.
So
yeah,
she had been, like, blindsided or something.
Yep. They knew something went wrong.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. You know, so you hear about that. People are so close to just, like, missing a serial killer or something. And
yeah. Yeah, we hear that too often.
Yeah, definitely. In light of its earlier estimation that the case was closed, the FBI remained relatively quiet about this.
Yeah, I wonder why.
Yeah, because they publicly said that, you know, they had the guy.
Yeah.
But then they publicly also said that, okay, maybe we should reevaluate this.
Yeah.
Even police in the news were saying whether the FBI could have done anything to prevent Joey Armstrong's murder.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a big deal. This tragedy brought back those nightmares that the local residents thought they could put behind them. Because she was just this young, beautiful girl, freckled, red-haired, and full of energy and enthusiasm.
Yeah, she had a lot of life ahead of her.
She loved children. That's why she did that job.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
She would, like, take kids to the park to kind of, like, educating children about the outdoors.
Okay.
In order to instill a healthy, lifelong love of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And it was her passion.
That's tragic.
This is a quote from the director of the Yosemite Institute.
Okay.
Joey was a bright light to all who knew her. We will remember her as so full of laughter and love and as a committed and gifted teacher.
Huh. That's so sad.
It really is. Authorities went to the meadow Joey Armstrong loved so much on Thursday, not long after she was reported missing, and found her body next to a stream, and then found her head nearby.
Oh, my God. He decapitated her.
Completely decapitated her.
My God.
And then, like, threw her head in the creek.
Jeez. What a sick man.
I can't even imagine doing that. So I was thinking about that, like, how much rage you must have.
Yeah, to be able to do that to someone, like, oh.
It's horrible.
I mean, I don't think that's a crime of passion.
Oh, no, no.
No, I mean, to be able to do that, like, that's not a crime of passion. That's a sociopath. That's a psychopath.
No, definitely, yeah. Definitely. On Saturday, July 24th, this was only 48 hours after Joey Armstrong homicide, FBI agent in charge, James Murdoch, announced at a press conference that a man was in custody already.
Okay.
Another man, I should say.
Gotcha.
On strong suspicion of murder, the suspect, Kerry Stainer, 37 years old, had been one of the people that was questioned after the triple murder in February.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, there was no evidence pointing to Stainer, and he was just released. It was just like a routine, you know, because he worked there.
Yeah, he didn't have really the evidence, or they didn't have the evidence to really
put him down. Or any suspicion at all, yeah. The reason they didn't suspect him is because they knew him as Steven Stainer's brother.
Ah.
You want to hear about Steven Stainer, buddy?
I do. Let's hear about Steven Stainer.
So, on the afternoon of December 4th, 1972, Steven Stainer was approached on his way home from school, a man named Irvin Edward Murphy.
Okay.
Who was acting on instructions from Keith Parnell, who's the true villain.
Okay.
Irvin Murphy had a learning disability, like he was like mentally handicapped.
Okay.
So he was basically coerced into helping this guy. He told him that he wanted a kid, like to raise a child.
Okay.
In better circumstances than he was in.
Okay.
So he didn't know what he really wanted him for.
Gotcha.
So he would have him like pass out like gospel to boys walking home from school.
Oh, really?
And then try and lure him to the car.
Oh, my God.
So Stainer later claimed that Murphy asked him if his mother would be willing to donate any items to the church.
Okay.
When the boy replied that he would, mm-hmm. Murphy then asked Stainer where he lived. And they were like a block away from where he lived.
Yeah.
And he pointed over there. He said, I can walk right over there. He's like, no, get in the car. We'll give you a ride.
Yeah.
So Stainer agreed and willingly got into the car with Murphy.
Yeah. And those were his last things, huh?
Parnell. Stance. Yeah. Parnell then drove very confused Stainer to his cabin instead of home.
Jeez.
And said, well, we're going to talk to your parents and have you spend the night. You know, and it's like, well, why would I be spending the night with you? He's like, oh. And unbeknownst to Stainer, Parnell's cabin is so sad. So the cabin he was keeping him at was at the same, like, near the trailer park that his grandfather lived.
Oh, really?
He was only 7, though. He didn't know.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
That very first night that he's there, Parnell molests him.
Oh, my God.
By molest, I mean raped.
Yeah.
I hate that word molest. It's really just child rape.
Yeah. Yeah. It's terrible, man.
So what Parnell did was, after talking with Steven and saying, oh, you've been getting in trouble lately, anything like that. He's like, yeah, I have. He's like, well, your parents don't want you anymore because you've been getting in trouble.
Oh, my God. Really?
And you have to come live with me now.
That's so terrible. Oh, that poor boy.
And he told him that he was given legal custody. His parents gave him up because he was no good.
Oh.
And that his parents just didn't want him anymore. Can you imagine a 7-year? I think of my son who's 6.
Yeah.
Like how easily, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, they would he be convinced of that? Like, they're so young.
They can be manipulated so easily that way.
Yeah. Just,
that's ridiculous, man. I'm so, that poor boy.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, it's so sad. And then Parnell began calling him Dennis Gregory Parnell.
So he changed his name.
He changes his name. He kept his middle name and his real birthday. Then he enrolled him in schools.
Really?
As his son. And like as far as Steven's concerned, his parents just gave him up.
Yeah.
And he's being groomed by this man.
Yeah.
And Parnell tells him, don't talk about your past life because your parents don't want you. There's no point.
Oh my God, he just brainwashed this kid.
He brainwashed him. So he's going to school every day, you know, like a normal kid. He was well liked. He was like well adjusted, or so they thought. Well adjusted kid.
Jeez.
And they moved a lot, though. Like, whenever he would think that somebody would be on to him or think something was weird, they would move.
Yeah.
And Parnell even allowed Steven to start drinking.
Oh, wow.
And do drugs. Anything to get his mind not straight, to be thinking clearly.
Right, right. That makes sense. Oh, my God.
It's just crazy how you can really manipulate a kid to that extent that you could send him to school and everything.
Yeah. Yeah, just make him believe whatever you want him to believe.
Yeah. And the really sick part of this, so for 18 months, there was a woman that was living with them. Okay. Barbara Mathias. Let's blow her spot up.
All right.
And she denies any of this, but this is according to Steven.
Okay.
That she, along with Parnell, raped him on 9 separate occasions.
Oh, my God.
And this is at the age of 9. And then in 1975, on Parnell's instruction, Mathias tried to lure another young boy who was in the Santa Rosa Boys Club with Stainer into Parnell's car. Mm-hmm. Thank God they were unsuccessful.
Oh, good.
But as Stainer entered puberty, Parnell began to look for younger boys to abduct.
What a sick man.
It really is sick.
Yeah.
So Parnell kept having Stainer come with him and be like, let's lure these boys. Mm-hmm. And Stainer would just sabotage the abductions.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Because he knew what the kid was in for.
Yeah.
So then, finally, Parnell's like, okay, well, Steven obviously doesn't have it in him to freaking get me a kid.
Yeah.
So what he does is he convinces one of his friends to help him kidnap another kid.
One of Stainer's kids or friends?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
On February 14th, 1980, Parnell and a teenage friend of Stainer's named Randall Sean Poorman kidnapped 5-year-old Timothy White.
Oh, my God. He's five. Oh, jeez.
If you see pictures of this kid, oh, my God. It's like, thank God he made it out all right because he's such a cutie. He's such a cutie.
Man.
And Stainer said as soon as they had this boy, he said it was his life's mission to get this kid out of there.
Oh, good for him.
Like, what a real hero.
Yeah, absolutely.
So on March 1st, 1980, while Parnell was away at work, like, every day, they would, like, wait for him to go to work. And then, like, one day they were going to do it, they were going to leave. And then he came back early from work.
Oh, jeez.
So then every day they're paranoid that he's going to come back and catch him.
Mm-hmm.
And, but he knows he's got to get this boy out of there.
Yeah.
But finally they do leave.
Oh, good.
They do leave.
Good.
March 1st, 1980. And then they run into some policemen, just happen to run into some policemen, spot them.
Okay.
And Stainer immediately identifies White. And then what he says is, I don't know, I know my name is Steven.
Okay.
Which became a movie, like a Lifetime movie or something.
Really?
And my name is Steve. All I know is my name is Steven.
Okay.
And he became like a nationwide, he was on like all the talk shows.
Okay.
He was a hero.
Awesome. Good I mean,
he was celebrated, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's finally back with his family.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
So by March 2nd, Parnell had been arrested on suspicion of abducting both boys.
Mm-hmm.
But since, like, he abducted both the boys, but he only had Timothy for a couple days.
Mm-hmm.
So Timothy's, like, not a very good witness because he's like, oh, he was nice.
Yeah.
We just played with toys. He hadn't yet molested him.
Yeah. He still abducted him, though.
So he's not, like, a good witness.
Yeah.
And, like, this is very hard for Steven to talk about.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because he's been put through trauma.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to talk about it even with his own family, but then he's put on stand.
Oh, yeah.
And especially then he's got to do it in court. He's so young still. Yeah. Right, this time he's 14.
Yeah.
So it was very hard. So he ends up only being sentenced to 7 years.
That's it? He basically destroyed this kid's life.
Yeah. All they got him for in the end was one count of kidnapping. Where now, like if the law in California changed because of this case, that like if you kidnap somebody like every day or whatever is a new kidnapping charge.
Okay.
Back then you just get one for the first kidnap and then you don't get anything for keeping him the whole time.
Oh, man. Yeah.
So he got out after 5 years.
Oh, my God. So he could just do it again. And he probably has.
It's unbelievable that... I don't even know how this happened. I really don't.
So what's this guy's name again?
Keith Parnell.
Yeah, stay the hell away from Keith Parnell.
Oh, he's dead now.
Good.
Because when he was 70, he tried to get his nurse to lure a boy there and help him get a boy. And she thought he was joking.
Are you
but
serious?
But then he kept saying to her, no, really, like, go get me a boy.
Really?
So he got, for that, attempted bribery of a nurse to kidnap a boy. He got 25 years to life.
Oh, wow. Good.
That's how much the law had changed in those years.
That's awesome. That is awesome. I mean, it's terrible that he would even try that, but that's, you know, put his ass back in jail.
So he died in prison.
Hang on.
He died in prison, so that's good. But the thing is that, so Stainer is, you know, brought back to his family. But things are not all hunky-dory. I mean, he's got a lot of PTSD.
Yeah.
And his father's against therapy. You don't need therapy. You're home now.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So he was just a tortured soul.
Yeah.
And things were not, like, It's so sad. Carrie, his older brother, said that he used to wish upon, every time there was a clear sky, he would wish upon a star that his brother be brought back to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he himself, at this time, is having a lot of dark thought.
Yeah.
So, and he's thinking about, and he's only at the time, his brother's taken like 14.
So his brother, yeah, so his brother was older than Carrie was older.
Yeah. And he's like already thinking about hurting the neighbors and stuff. So he thinks that it's karma that his brother got taken. He thought that he caused it by having these dark thoughts.
Oh, interesting.
And the family's like, okay, well, now we got this kid back 7 years later. Now he drinks and smokes.
Yeah.
And like, he's got so much PTSD, though. The mom's like, I don't want to make him stop.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of feel horrible.
Oh my God.
The dad's not helping anything because he's like, you don't show your emotions. You be a man. Suck it up.
Yeah.
Like, that ever works.
Suck all that up. Yeah. Oh, man. Bottling up stuff doesn't work.
No, I really don't. So it was just a bad situation, you know. It was like, on the TV, you'd see them and they'd be like this happy family, but it really wasn't a happy family.
Yeah. That's tragic, man. I mean, it's great that they got out, but wow. So we got a little mini-sode inside of our, inside of this podcast, so.
Yeah, I did a lot of research for this one, let me tell you.
Yeah.
And the saddest part is, Stephen goes on, he gets, And then Stephen at school is getting bullied by kids saying, oh, you were asking for it.
Really?
And getting like abused in the showers by other kids.
Oh, God.
And like calling him a wuss and stuff like that. Like, that would never happen to me.
Yeah. Freaking kids, man.
So he was tortured.
Yeah.
And his older brother, Kerry, was very jealous once he was back.
Yeah.
He was getting all the attention. They would even forget to set the table for Carrie.
Really?
Yeah. And Stephen would have to remind him.
Aw, man. That's not right.
And his father said they took the wrong child. Oh. Talking about Carrie. Can you imagine that?
Man, reminds me of Stand By Me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in 1985, Stephen married 17-year-old Jody Edmondson. And they had two children. And he worked with child abduction groups. He spoke to children about safety.
Yeah. Awesome.
And he could give interviews about his kidnapping.
Yeah. Good. So he
was trying to do good in the world.
Yeah. Silver lining there, you know.
But he was dying on the inside.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he wouldn't talk about the abuse with anybody, not even his wife.
Yeah.
He would say it happened, but that was it. And he was just like, his father ingrained in him to keep it inside.
Oh, man, that must have been eating him up.
Yeah, I can't imagine. So on September 16th, 1989, Stephen Stainer sustained fatal head injuries while on his way home from work when his motorcycle collided with a car in a hit-and-run accident.
Oh, man. What a tragic end.
500 people attended his funeral.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ooh, gave me chills.
It's really sad that he really was a hero, you know, and then to die so young.
Yeah.
He was only 24. And he was, like, trying to make sure that something like that never happened to another kid.
Yeah, he was doing his part.
Yeah, it's so sad. What a good person.
Mm-hmm.
What a real hero to save that. Timothy, so sad. Timothy White that he saved was a pallbearer at his funeral.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he saved his life.
It's horrible. So back to his scumbag brother, Kerry.
And here we are, back to the horrible person.
So now, after there was another murder, he was again let in for questioning. This time they had a little more, though, because the tire tracks at the scene matched his tire tracks.
Oh, interesting.
And he denied being in the area, but he was seen by two police officers in the area.
Really?
So now, they're not thinking, like, they're not, but he's, like, so charming and so nice, and they're not thinking that, like, he is the murderer, but maybe that he saw something and doesn't want to say.
Gotcha.
He's like a reluctant witness.
Yeah, well, he's been through trauma, so maybe he doesn't want to go through more trauma or something like that. Yeah.
So they interview him, and then they tell him, you know, don't leave the area. We want to talk to you again.
Mm-hmm.
So he flees to a nudist colony.
Not nudist colony.
And in the meantime, they match up the tire tracks.
Yep.
And stuff like that, and they're like, oh, we better find this guy.
Yeah.
So he's arrested at the nudist colony, which is so weird.
Being arrested. I wonder if the police had to take off their clothes.
They're so funny. That's a porno there, right there.
Yeah, right. That's how pornos start.
So he was arrested on Friday evening, July 23rd. And basically, like, as soon as he was arrested, like, at first he's denying it. But his guilt really is getting to him. Like, he was one of those killers that he was a killer. He was a cold-blooded murderer. Mm-hmm. But he hated that part of himself.
Gotcha.
He was like an Ed Kemper, you know?
Yeah.
Because once he was arrested and he's in the interview room, he couldn't help himself. He had to give it up. He just finally puts his heart in his hand and he's like, I'm a horrible person. I'm a horrible. They're like, what are you talking about? Why?
Oh, wow.
And the cops are literally like, I'm watching the interviews with these guys and they're like, yeah, we had no idea.
Oh, wow.
We had no idea that he was that. Wow, we're like, we got these meth heads that look exactly like the type of people that would kill somebody and chop their head off in custody. Yeah. And this guy is like the opposite of that. There's no way he's the killer.
Just goes to show you, you know, you never know who someone is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're like, he's too nice.
Yeah.
But Carrie had like bonded with this FBI detective over the fact that he knew about his brother until he talked about it and everything and how his brother had died. So he like felt close enough with this detective that he wanted to tell him the truth.
Okay.
In the interview, Carrie said he had been fantasizing about killing women for 30 years since he was 7 years old.
Wow. 7 years old?
Yeah.
Wow.
And by the age of 10, he talked about having a dungeon where he would keep women.
Jeez.
That was like his fantasy life that early on.
That is sick.
He told investigators that he entered the motel room. He said the mother was reading and the two teenage girls were watching Jerry Maguire.
Jerry Maguire. Wow, flashback.
I went and seen that in movie theaters that summer.
Oh, interesting.
No, I don't know. I did go see it in the movie theaters, though. He said he had to fix something in the bathroom. And it's crazy. At first, they wouldn't let him in. He's like, all right. He was backing off.
Yeah.
And then he's like, well, you might have to move your room then. And then she's like, all right, come
in. They didn't want to move the room. They should have just.
It's crazy because it's not like he really would have had to move the room. I mean, they would have been, it's like, what could have been? But once inside, he pulled out a gun, told them that he was desperate, and he just wanted money. And he orders Carol and her daughter onto the bed with Sylvina. After binding their hands with duct tape and gagging them. Okay, they're all freaking out. So he takes the two girls in the bathroom, the two younger girls.
Yeah.
And then he, with a 3-foot piece of rope, strangles Carol to death.
Oh my God.
He's like, he said, this is a quote, I didn't realize how hard it is to strangle a person.
No, wow.
It's not easy, he said. But he said he had very little feeling while doing it.
Oh, jeez.
It's like, who did we do a couple weeks? Joel Rifkin, when he said that the murders were no passion involved, no hatred at all.
Yeah.
It was just like completing a task.
Yeah.
So then after he kills Carol, he shoves her body in the trunk of their car, the red car.
Yeah.
And then goes back in for the girls.
Oh, my God.
Cuts their clothes off of them. Makes them, like, mess around with each other.
Oh, my God.
So he's trying to get hard.
Yeah.
And he can't. So then what does he do? Of course, he's going to take his frustration out on them.
Yep.
So he starts abusing them. He's trying to rape them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're freaking out, too. So he, like, okay, screw this. So he takes Sylvina into the bathroom, strangles her in the tub, then goes back in for Julie.
Oh, my God. Oh, man.
And then he sexually assaults Julie in the hotel room. Finally, he left Julie on the bed, tied up and watching TV. And he cleans up the crime scene. Like, he cleaned up everything. That's why they didn't find anything.
Yeah.
And, and so he made the room look like, the next morning, he, like, wetted down towels and stuff so that it would look like, in the morning when they came to clean the room, that, everybody got up, they took a shower.
Yeah.
And they left.
Normal, yeah.
And left the keys on the counter.
Yep.
So that it gave him more time to do what he needed to do.
Oh, my God.
And he even wiped like his hairs off the bed sheet. I mean, he really cleaned this room.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, how did you know to do this stuff? He's like, I watch Discovery Channel.
Jeez.
He's like, I listen to Murder Incorporated podcasts, and I've got a lot of...
Yeah, of course, you know.
Another killer that listens to us, buddy. All right.
But 100% of our viewers, our listeners, have not been murdered.
Yes. That is a fact, folks.
Hey, while we're talking about Murder Incorporated podcast, where can they email us?
At murderincorporatedpod@gmail.com.
And where can they Twitter us at?
At Murder Inc. Pod.
That's right. We also have a Patreon, so if you would like to become a sustaining member of Murder Incorporated Podcast, please go to patreon.com/murderincorporated, and we have extra content coming out, and we have a bunch of freebies, a bunch of merchandise we can send to you, and yeah, please do that.
Yes, please do. So, at about 4 a.m., Carrie wraps Julie's naked body in a pink motel blanket and then drove away in the rental car. He said he didn't know where he was going or what he was doing. He just drove and drove. He just wanted to keep this girl with him.
Jeez.
He's like, I came to like this girl after kidnapping her.
She was still alive then.
Yeah, she's not done yet.
Oh, man.
And he said that she was
that
like,
be going through
oh, I know.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
And, like, by this point, she knows now that her mom's dead.
Yeah.
That Savina's dead.
Yep.
So she's, like, got to be losing her mind. But he said that she stayed very calm and just did what he asked. And he said that right before he killed her, he told her he wished he could keep her.
What a sick, sick man.
So he said he laid her down in the field, brushed her hair to the side, and then he whispered, I love you, into her ear. And then slit her throat ear to ear.
What a sick man.
He said he didn't want her to suffer like the other ones did. So that's why he slit her throat ear to ear.
Yeah, such passion for this man. Such empathy he had for her. What a
horrible.
Sick man.
After hiding her body in the thicket, he drove the car with the bodies of Carol's son and Sylvina Pelosa in the trunk as far as he could into the forest. Then he took a cab back to Yosemite, $150 cab ride.
Wow.
That he used the money that he stole from.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And then 2 days later, he returns to the car with a can of gasoline. And he said that he scratched We Have Sarah onto the hood of the car with a pocket knife.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was the one that sent that letter earlier, too, saying where to find her body, Julie's.
Oh, really?
And the reason that he did it, he said that I was watching an interview or something. And he's like, the reason I did it is because people at work were talking about it. And they were saying that even though people suspected that she was dead, for the family to get closure, at least they should know. And he's like, and then the next day I send out the letter.
Oh, wow.
That's what he says, at least.
Wow. It's like he has feeling or something like that.
Yeah, he's something. So he left the rental car with the bodies of Mrs. Sun and Sylvina inside, and came back later to burn the evidence and retrieve the wallet, which he dumped in Modesto to confuse the police. And he thought he had gotten away with it, and that was going to be it.
Yeah.
Well, I got away with this. I'm done. I'm not going to do it anymore. And then he sees Joey Armstrong.
And he just got to do it again.
He starts talking to her. He's really attracted to her. He's like, I didn't want to do it, but then as soon as I started talking to her, he's like, I gotta take this girl.
Wow.
And then he gets her in the truck with the gun, gets her to go in the truck, and then as soon as they start driving down the road, she jumps out of the window and starts running. So now he's pissed.
Oh, wow.
That's why he cut her head off to teach her a lesson for freaking running away.
Yeah.
I mean, he was gonna kill her no matter what, but.
Right.
And his final words were, I'm sorry their loved ones were where they were when they were. I wish I could have controlled myself and not done what I did.
It's like just a slap in the face when you hear their final words.
Yeah. I mean, not his final words, but that's what those final statement to the press.
Yeah.
FBI sources claimed that he had already confessed his guilt during the Saturday evening interrogation. in the FBI's mind, this time I had the right man.
Yeah. This time.
He had given the FBI details, to be fair, that only the killer would have known.
Yeah.
And then they found knives when they searched his apartment that he believed that one of them was to kill Joey, that was used to kill Joey.
Gotcha.
Everybody was blown away that it was him.
Yeah.
Like, people could not believe that he confessed.
Well, yeah. I mean, you go from the brother who's a hero to the other brother who's a psychopath murderer.
He wasn't a troublemaker. He wasn't a wise ass. He was never violent. Nothing.
Yeah, nothing.
Like, there was no signs.
Yeah. That's crazy.
He was just a quiet but friendly guy.
Oh, man.
I mean, nothing at all pointed towards, oh, he's going to be a murderer.
That's crazy.
But at the trial, he tries claiming insanity and saying that, oh, when my younger brother Stephen got taken, all that trauma, and he tried saying his dad sexually abused him and all this stuff.
Oh, really?
Unfounded.
Yeah.
I mean, his dad was definitely an asshole, but.
Yeah.
So that's the story of the Stanger family, buddy.
Wow.
What do you think?
It was interesting. I think I say everything's interesting. That's my word.
It was interesting.
I mean, the two stories in one is what got me, man. I love the hero story in there, but what a sick man Carrie was.
Yeah, definitely.
Why did he go off the deep end, man? Why did those women have to die? Like, what pushed him to that? Like,
this is one that I believe that he was just born evil because he was having those fantasies at 7 years old.
Yeah, I mean, really, there's no way that his brother's kidnapping really drove him to that.
I don't believe so.
I don't think so. I mean, I could imagine that maybe his family could have pushed him over the edge. But no, he was already, you're right, he was pretty much born evil. And maybe he could have controlled him a little better if his father wasn't, his father, and kind of, made him feel like, oh, I wish you were the one taken and whatnot, it didn't kill his self-esteem. But, yeah, man, this is a really, really tough story because, I mean, poor women. Those poor women. That's all I've seen.
Yeah, really. Their last moments was horrifying. Horrifying.
Yeah.
And all so young,
Yeah.
So crazy.
Mm-hmm.
The father, Junes,
mm-hmm.
He's like, he's like, I have other children. I had to move on.
Yeah.
He's like, I just don't see it as respecting the lives that were lost by us losing our lives also.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, yeah. I mean, you obviously got to move on, but how do you move on from that,
It's so traumatizing.
Yeah.
Just knowing that somebody you love so much, that's how they died.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you forget that? And how do you move on? How do you live with your life after that?
Yeah, truly. Truly. I mean, oh, God. And that Joey, she just seemed like she was so full of life, and she cared about people and loved children, and then to be beheaded like that.
Yeah, that's sick.
Yeah, he was sentenced to death, actually. I forgot to tell you that.
Oh, yeah.
So he ends up getting sentenced to death for the three murders.
Okay.
And then Joey's family was against the death penalty and didn't want to go through a trial.
Oh, really?
So, in that case, they didn't even go to trial.
Oh, really?
Because he was already sentenced to death three times.
Yeah.
So he's awaiting execution now in California.
Oh, really?
San Quentin.
So he may not even be executed.
No, he'll probably die of old age.
Yeah. Yeah, especially in California, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't think... California, do they still have the death penalty?
They have it, but it's like, they're still trying to find the right chemicals to mix to, because companies don't want to sell it for lethal injection if they know you're going to use it for that.
Ah.
So they're trying to come up with a chemical compound to kill these suckers.
Yeah.
Just do it like Russia, man. They freaking shoot you in the back of the head and charge your family for the bullet.
Jeez.
So that's what they should do here.
Yeah. That's the easy way out, though.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's like, how good these guys got it on death row is unbelievable. They got their own cell. They got a TV.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they got three straight meals, you know.
It's like, I just hope these people are, like, living in fear every day that they're going to freaking figure it out and put them to death. I really hope they are.
Yeah.
But I doubt
it. The only issue with the death penalty is you got to be sure you got the right guy.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's the only issue. We're not here to discuss that. We're here to discuss Murder Incorporated cases.
And Gary Stainer, this evil piece of crap. I just can't believe it, buddy.
Yeah.
This is an interesting story that one brother's a real hero and then the other one's a freaking psychopathic killer.
Yeah, real scumbag. Two polar opposites.
So if you like this story or you didn't like it, you can write us at where, buddy?
MurderIncorporatedPod@gmail.com.
Or Twitter us at
MurderIncPod.
That's right. Or search us on Instagram.
Yeah, Murder Incorporated.
Pod. Oh, okay, sorry.
Also, check out our YouTube page.
Yes, definitely.
We put up a video every week. Just kind of giving you a little snippet of the case that we're doing every week. You know, just silly little clippets of us, you know, talking back and forth and, you know, having some fun. You know, short 4 or 5 minute videos. Check us out. Subscribe.
Yeah, we got 20 subscribers, buddy.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
Woohoo, a whole 20.
And when we get to 100, well, we appreciate those 20. When we get to 100, we're going to do a raffle.
Yes, we are. We'll be throwing out some free murder merch.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. If we get to 1 million, we will kill a person of your choice. I don't even care. I'll do it. I don't even care.
He'll do it. He will do it.
The listeners will vote.
All right, man. Well.
Hi, welcome to The Jury Room, a true crime podcast. My name is Kevin, and I will be your host on this journey. We will be covering some of the most heinous, some of the most unthinkable, and some of the most monstrous crimes to ever be committed against humanity. We will be covering cannibalistic serial killers, decades-old unsolved mysteries, cold cases, missing person cases, and everything in between. The Jury Room podcast is available on most major podcasting platforms. Please make sure you go subscribe and leave a review.